Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and today I'm pleased to welcome our Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis, UW-Madison Professor of Horticulture, Gardening Haiku Poet, and Erwin Goldman, Professor of Horticulture, Associate Dean of the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, our other guest today, and the other vicars. So, it's vegetable time on Garden Talk, and if you have a question about your vegetables, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at, or maybe you've got a haiku, you can bring that along too with you. 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison, reach us at 263-1890. Give a call. Jim, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
Erwin, thank you for coming by.
It's my pleasure, Larry. Thanks for having us.
I tell you what, the tomatoes were getting a bad rap for a while, and they have now been cleared, as I understand it, and the chilies are getting a bad rap because of the salmonella poisoning.
Erwin, this is personally painful for me. Help me understand this.
Well, both tomatoes and peppers, and for the peppers, it was both jalapenos and serranos that were unfairly maligned here. Yes.
If only it had been the bell pepper, I'd feel better about this.
That
would have worked, but not the serrano.
Yeah. I think it was on July 17th or somewhere in the middle of July when the FDA actually lifted the ban lifted the warning, I guess, against eating raw tomatoes for salmonella. But during that time period, the estimate from the Produce Association was that the tomato industry lost $100 million from that, $100 million. So that's a really big loss and to perhaps not even be the source of the salmonella.
And so now are the chilies taking a hit?
I believe so, because it appears that not only the jalapenos, but also serranos were viewed as a possible source of that salmonella.
Were these imported or produced here domestically in the U.S.?
I think they were from Mexico.
I think they were from outside of the country.
That's too bad, because the serrano, as our lucky listeners know, is of course the pepper of choice for pico de gallo.
Yeah,
right. Which is one of the best salsas available. It doesn't do well here in Wisconsin. I've never found really a serrano that does all that well because it tends to produce and flower very late. Mm. But late in the season, you can enjoy a pico de gallo. What is a well-adapted pepper to Wisconsin?
Is the
jalapeno, not the serrano, but the jalapeno.
The jalapeno.
I would have to say it is very well-adapted to Wisconsin. It tends to flower, and there's a variety called early jalapeno itself, which is actually very well-adapted.
Isn't the jalapeno, the quality of the jalapeno from a flavor point of view, isn't heat, hot temperatures give a better pepper? What's your sense of that?
That's an interesting thing. You know, one of the classic salsas, you know, was a salsa called Pace salsa.
Yeah.
You know, what was the commercial? Not produced in New York,
right?
That was the Pace salsa.
Right, yeah.
But they used very fresh ingredients in the Pace salsa, and I knew the gentleman from New Mexico who actually bred a jalapeno that had no heat at all, no capsaicin whatsoever. And what Pace would do is that they would use the jalapeno exclusively for flavor. And, of course, because the capsaicin is easily extracted, it's alcohol soluble, they would do an extraction, you know, independent of the jalapenos themselves, and they would put in one drop or two drops or three drops for low, medium, high. So I don't know. It's sad, you know.
Well,
it's sad in a way.
Mary and Toma has a question for you. Oops, just a second here.
It's kind of artificial, isn't it?
Push the wrong button here.
Yeah, I mean,
Mary and Toma, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My pepper plants have all incurred hail damage, and I'm getting lots of blossoms now. They don't look too bad considering the hail damage. And I'm wondering, because I don't have that much fruit set yet, what can I put on them to give them a little boost?
Wow. You know, I would say that, let's see, you're in Toma. Over the years, we've had some really erratic summers, right? I mean, this is all the global warming issue. And sometimes we will get pollen blasting in peppers. This I've noticed over the last few years. In other words, when we get, I think it was 2 years ago, or maybe it was last year, we had these temperatures that just rose to the sky. And what would happen, of course, is that you'd get thousands of flowers, you'd get no fruit set. And that's because, you know, fertilization is simply not occurring. It's called the phenomenon is referred to in the industry as pollen blasting, right? So my guess is that as you move into lower temperatures, right, as we move into the end of our glorious summer, I believe that you will have, my prediction is copious fruit scent, but of course your peppers are going to be late. And so mm-hmm. you're going to have copious fruit scent mm-hmm. and a lot of fruit in September.
And there's not a lot you can do. I mean, fertilizing or anything like that's not really going to help, is it?
Probably at this point, no. I mean, if they've already flowered.
Not at this point.
You're only going to pollute the groundwater at this point. I think I would say,
okay, well, then
I would say show restraint and have faith. It's
and,
all about faith.
Cover them if it gets close to frost. Maybe
that's
I
right.
can extend it out a little.
That's right.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Mary. Yvonne has a question for you now from Spring Green. Yvonne, hello to you.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. This year I planted an eggplant. Actually, it's the first time I've planted
that
eggplant.
First mistake, Yvonne.
Yes, exactly. And it is the type of eggplant, name I don't know, that is not dark purple. It has white and a medium shade of purple. But anyway, I have these gorgeous eggplants on. I don't know when to pick them. How do you know when they're ripe and ready?
Yvonne, I don't know how to break this to you, but you've asked the two guys that you should not ask this question to.
I see.
I don't know if you're fully aware that we are very democratic here at the University of Wisconsin, and it's certainly in our class. And Irwin and I voted 2 years ago, and we voted the eggplant out as a vegetable.
So the kinds of uses we can recommend will be non-food uses for the eggplant. It's an excellent sponge.
Yeah, racquetball. It can be a weapon.
Now we had a student 1 year who insisted, and he was an outstanding chef, who insisted that he could make a dish, and I believe he made a moussaka, didn't he, with that eggplant, where he roasted them? Didn't he roast that eggplant?
Yeah, was that Johnny?
It might have been Johnny who made that. And I would say that bordered on, that was quite.
It almost approached being reinstated as a vegetable. By the way, because you have to have five vegetables a day, and we eliminated the eggplant, we did make a substitution, and we substituted chocolate.
Chocolate, excellent.
So, okay. So it's not, not all is lost. Now, moussaka, I do believe, approaches... It almost led me to reinstate it.
Yeah,
as a vegetable.
It was an excellent attempt because of the way he roasted it.
But remember the girl who brought in the incredibly delicious eggplant parmesan.
Yes. I like eggplant parmesan.
So do I. On the other hand, Larry, we have to face the grim reality that you can go. You don't need the eggplant to make eggplant parmesan. You can go to Menards. You can buy that 2 for $0.39. Package of cellulose sponges, and if you soak those with enough parmesan cheese and egg
and oil
you get exactly the same dish. In fact, it has a better texture.
Terms of telling when these eggplants are actually ready to harvest, how big are they right now, by the way?
Well, mine is good four inches in diameter. It's a bit more round than the traditional dark purple.
Well, it's not as if they're going to develop a ripe bouquet and an exceedingly high level of sugars. We are talking about the vegetable sponge here.
Yes.
I would say, whenever...
4 inches in diameter,
the sooner the
better. Ready.
The sooner the better. Yeah, I would pick them soon. And in fact, I'd like to put in a plug for if you're going to eat eggplant, the very, very young fruits, very small fruits, are eaten in Asia and in the Middle East. They're often pickled and they're cooked. And I think actually...
Maybe you could pickle it and make it a good vegetable.
It's very good pickled, and you don't have the same texture that a more mature fruit has. So my recommendation to you... Yvonne, is to actually pick them soon. And pick the next ones young. And pick them.
Basically, get rid of them from your garden as quickly as possible by eliminating the young fruit.
I take it you really recommend I contribute it to my compost pile, but I will pick it and see how it goes.
Excellent.
All right,
excellent.
Thanks,
I'm so glad we were able to be objective about that.
Carl in River Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Carl.
Hi there. I've got a question about tomatoes, but first, have you ever had baba ganoush with eggplant?
Okay. That's a good dish. Now you've
got
a good
point
there.
I don't think you can make baba ganoush with a Menard sponge.
No, you can't.
No. Good point.
Okay.
My question about tomatoes is you know, I've heard about black plastic for blight and about rotating, but there's just so much rotating you can do in your garden before you've covered all. I still have tremendous amounts of blight. Is there anything else that I can do?
I don't know the relationship between black plastic and blight.
The blight comes from the soil, they say, and the splashing of the soil.
Yeah.
The plastic helps to relieve that problem.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. I
do, however, use a lot of black plastic, or at least an array of colors. I wouldn't say they're all black, but I do. I'm big on plastic. There's no doubt about that. And I'm also a very big on leaf mulch. That's a biggie for me. And I think you're going to get late blight regardless.
What do the tomato plants look like? Are the leaves curling up on you, or are they?
Yeah, it's starting to turn brown and yellow and starting to die. They start from the bottom and they kind of work their way up.
That could be a lot of things. You know, that could be fusarium. That could be. Now, you mentioned earlier that you were having a little trouble rotating. Now, you can build up a lot of soil pathogens, and these are not necessarily going to be, you know, Phytophthora. I would guess that you know what you can build up a lot of? And I had this problem over at Eagle Heights because I was limited in my rotation. I built up fusarium. At very high levels, and I had to rotate out because of that. You definitely want to go to any extreme possible to make sure that you rotate between all solanaceous crops and others. My rotation is between solanaceae and aliaceae. Mm. This is the rotation that I use even in my
garden. Do you have the
garden.
Leeks? So you have the leeks?
The leeks.
Yeah.
The leeks and onions are half the garden 1 year, and then the peppers and tomatoes are the other.
Yeah.
Tell me, Irwin, I'm fascinated. I'm sorry, George. Your question has taken me down another path, if you may permit me. And that is, when we were walking up here, Irwin was telling me about some fascinating aspects of solanaceae and alkaloids. Would you care to relate that?
Well, there's a widespread belief, and I'm sure some of our listeners will be familiar with this, that solanaceae vegetables, and I'm talking about potato, eggplant, tomato, pepper, these nightshade-like plants contribute to joint pain, right? Larry, have you heard of this? People that avoid these plants as a way of improving health and improving particularly of joint discomfort, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very widespread belief. I'm not advocating that it's backed up by solid medical science, nor do I know the medical science behind it. But nevertheless, it is a very widespread belief, and there are books on this subject. So we suspect that alkaloids are the cause of that.
The two most common ones are the solanine and tomatine, right?
The two most common alkaloids,
right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There must be an array of others that may contribute to this joint. Are you aware of this story?
I've heard the story. Yeah, I have heard this story.
So it goes beyond
but
urban
I don't know.
Legend.
Yeah, but I'm not. I haven't seen any research on it.
I haven't either.
So I don't know that it's actually been researched, to be perfectly honest.
I don't know either, but we have known people who clearly do this. They clearly avoid these vegetables, sadly, really, for health reasons. So maybe listeners have comments
on
that.
I'd be interested in if listeners have had their own experiences with the members of the solanaceae and joint pain. I'm having a little trouble with my arm right now. It's caused by excessive, you know, alkaloids consumption through tomatoes and peppers, I'm going to have to make some tough choices.
That would be very difficult
because
for you.
I'm not giving up my veggies.
In terms of the tomato blight, there's not.
Oh, I'm sorry. Back to the actual question.
Let's get back to the question. In terms of the blight itself, if you can't rotate, you almost have to. I mean, what does it
containers?
Take?
Containers? You could grow in containers.
I think you've got it. I mean, honest to God, I mean, you're going to get late blight here. You're going to get early blight early, and you're going to get late blight late in the state of Wisconsin. There are varieties that have some level of resistance, but the pathogen evolves so rapidly that it's almost impossible to stay ahead of it. I think, I don't know, I'm willing to take my losses. You know, late in the season when I get late blight, I simply try to harvest my tomatoes early enough. One strategy that I do use is that I tend to grow, I tend to stagger my tomato plantings a little bit so that I have plants that are just, you know, producing late in the season, because the younger plants don't seem to be affected as much as the older plants do. And I'll be honest with you, I simply take my losses, right? And how do I compensate for this? Canning is the way to compensate for this. You're going to get an abundance of tomatoes, right, early in September. Those 2 weeks, you should be out there with canning your tomatoes and saving them. Mm-hmm. And then when the early blight hits, you can just laugh. Right? It's almost
or when
giggling.
When the late blight
hits. Right, when the late blight hits.
So you early don't have blight. A magic spray?
No.
I don't have a magic bullet for late blight. I just say we just have to learn to work with it, not fight it.
Thanks very much for calling. I canned in the past. I haven't done this for a while now, but I was canning tomato. I would make a V8 type tomato juice out of those tomatoes in September. And I usually make about 50 quarts.
Wow.
I'd have a quart a week for...
with a little vodka. Don't you get this sense? That twinkle in his eye tells me that V8 juice was combined with other liquids.
Jim Nienhuis and Irwin Goldman are Vicars of Vegetables. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our hot air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking vegetables today with our Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Irwin Goldman, professors of horticulture at the UW-Madison. Glad to have them along. And, of course, we're always interested in haikus as well. Yeah. So, if you have one of those, give us a call. Karen in Greenbush is up next, so let's go to her. Karen, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I share their love of the chili,
but
I also have to disagree with them about the eggplant. And I do have a haiku for them today.
All right, let's hear it.
Rain, heat, the garden flourish. Aubergine beauty, roasted sweet. Sure to nourish.
Aubergine, you see, I'm willing to accept it as a haiku, but I don't see you, I don't think you fully appreciate the contradiction in the last line. Now, can we change that to chili pepper flourish? The aubergine, I don't think that's appropriate. She tried to sneak that one in, didn't she? That was a sneaky approach, Karen.
It was
a good shot. But, yeah, I'm still voting it out.
Read it again to me once. Rain, heat.
Rain, heat, the garden flourish, aubergine beauty, roasted sweet, sure to nourish.
Roasted sweet, aubergines.
They are delicious roasted. With a little salt and pepper, oh, they're wonderful.
Have you tried the 2 for $29 sponge at Menards?
That I have not.
It's pretty much the same thing. I think if all you have to do in this haiku is substitute chili pepper, beauty, roasted, sweet. And then I think we still maintain not only the structure of the haiku, but enhance the meaning and flourishing of this particular haiku. Don't you think, Irwin?
Yeah, it would work for me with that substitution.
I think we're just going to
a little editorial.
We're just
going to
do a little substitution input. There. Yeah.
Thanks, Garrett.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Dorothy in St. Germain, it's your turn. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question regarding the pH of the soil in the garden in particular and also in the flower area.
Okay.
And my pH is running between 7 and 7.6 in almost all areas, and that includes the garden soil. And primary plants are growing are the tomatoes and the strawberries that I'm concerned about and think I need to acidify the soil somewhat. And I'm wondering if you agree with that, and if so, how do I go about it and when?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a pretty good pH to me. I mean, a little, right at neutral, a little basic.
It's in some spots.
Got some limestone there.
Definitely on the neutral, and other spots go on up to, 7.
Why are you concerned about this pH thing?
Well,
are you not getting good growth?
Oh, right.
What
with
about,
radishes, for example.
Well,
beautiful top growth, but nothing underneath. Pepper plants, a lot of foliage, but never really get any pepper.
That doesn't have anything to do with the acidity of the soil or the...
You know, I think you might want to look at, the structure of the soil more. I mean, that pH doesn't blow me away. I mean, if you'd said my pH is 2, uh-huh. then I'd say you've got some issues out there. Uh-huh. On the other hand, a pH of 7 to 7.5 seems pretty nice. I think you may want to look at other issues, specifically the structure of the soil.
I think you're looking at some high nitrogen soil there.
Maybe some, incorporate organic matter would be my thought.
If you have luxuriant top growth, but very little fruit set or very little roots, you mentioned in the case of the radishes, that strikes me as being...
High nitrogen.
Yeah, yeah.
Much nitrogen.
Well, I would potentially,
and you could kill both birds with one stone, right? By incorporating organic matter.
Yeah, that would be an excellent choice. Yeah. Do you have access to some type of a mulch that you could incorporate?
I would have leaves. Mm-hmm. That would be about.
You could mulch the eggplant, before they mature, and use those effectively. Leaf mulch is terrific. Leaf mulch is just absolutely terrific. I would say you probably want to. I mean, I would look at other things other than chemical amendments to change the pH of my soil.
Did you do a nitrogen phosphorus? Did you do a
no? An analysis of the.
Doing a soil test would be a great idea.
Soil test.
Yeah, you can do a soil test.
Uh-huh.
I bet you're high in nitrogen if you're getting that kind of top growth.
Not only that, it's a tough haiku, the pH haiku, because is that one syllable or two?
Yeah.
My pH is high. I'm struggling with the haiku itself. Uh-huh.
There certainly are plants. I mean, you mentioned you're growing berries. Blueberries, for example, are acid loving, and for that you would need to decrease your pH, but.
I have some strawberries.
I think you're okay where you are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing I have used is pine needles mulching.
Well, that will acidify the soil.
Mm-hmm.
That would what?
That will acidify the soil.
Yeah, okay. That'll bring your pH down.
So that would be a good one. I covered some things, in the fall to prevent.
Honest to God, I think I'm not. Of course, this is great. I don't even know her garden, never saw it.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is the pH. And why am I so adamant in recommending leaf mulch?
You're an expert.
Because it solves everything. That's why.
Everything needs leaf mulch.
Yeah, just incorporate leaf mulch.
Okay.
Send out the significant other with with copious amounts, a wheelbarrow after wheelbarrow and a spade, and just have him dig.
Okay.
All right, good luck.
And do that in the fall. And then by spring, it should be
fine. And then plant and then just cover between your rows with leaf mulch.
With leaf mulch.
Yeah.
Now, it should be mulched up. I mean, those leaves should not be...
Right, whole. They should...
Right.
Yeah.
And
put them in the blender.
And better, yes. And frankly, the best is if they've sat a year. What'll happen... I mean, certainly you can put them, incorporate them into the soil, but what will happen is they will tie up the nitrogen.
They'll mass.
Well, that's what she needs, right?
Hey, I'm
a fresh leaf guy. Harvest them in the fall, apply them in the spring.
Or do both, and that'll keep everything.
Yeah.
But work them into the soil.
Okay, now the leaves I've got are maple leaves and some oak leaves. That's the kind of leaf we want.
Those are fine.
Yep. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Calling. Appreciate your call. And Mike in Hastings is up next. So let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Good morning. I had a wonder if either of you two gentlemen had ever heard of a Spanish pepper. If I'm mispronouncing that, you'll have to help me. A piquillo pepper.
Piquillo?
And where I might avail myself of seeds or plants for something like that.
Do you know the spelling?
Heat level. I do not.
Chili
piquin.
Chili piquin.
These grow all over the Southwest. These are wild. There aren't a lot of vegetables that are native to the United States, actually. But, the chili piquin, if you go down to the Southwest in September, right, like New Mexico and Arizona, mm-hmm. those chili piquins grow wild. Right. And they look, and they're tiny little peppers.
Is it upright?
Yeah, it's a very, well, no, it's not. It's not a frutescens. It's an annuum.
It's annuum.
Yeah, it's annuum. But every plant is covered like 10,000 little mm-hmm. colorful, and of course they have the carotenoids, and we also have the
anthocyanins,
as pigments. So they're amazingly colorful. And the birds just descend on these chili piquins and eat them, and then they disseminate the seeds. they disseminate a lot of those seeds onto the windshields of cars that drive through the Southwest, and that's probably the number one dispersal. Isn't Mother Nature clever?
Yeah.
How would Mother Nature have guessed?
So that is
you need the interstate highway system.
The
for
interstate
that,
highway that's system would be a mechanism of dispersal. How Mother Nature could have anticipated that is beyond me.
So that's the P-I-Q-U-I-L-L-O.
Oh, I don't know.
No, that's something different. Chili
that's
pecan.
Different. This is yeah. You didn't let me spell it out.
Oh, you didn't, oh, I didn't. Oh hell!
But
I
you
just
gave useful
first
information anyway.
Well,
you gave some useful information.
I didn't
information.
Hear the rest of the spelling.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that illo on there.
Piquillo?
Piquillo? Is that the one that you were talking about?
I think that's the way it's Piquillo. That's the way I've heard it pronounced, but yeah. I have no idea.
That's Spanish.
Yeah.
Jim and I do that in class all the time. We sometimes answer a question
before it's even asked.
Well, or the question we'd like to answer rather than the one that was necessarily
is that why the
asked.
Exactly. Is back there just giving us that evil stare?
Piquillo, I've never heard of.
Okay.
Well, now, what would that actually, I'm trying
Spanish,
to think.
Spanish, it means little beak.
That's what I think I remembered. Small,
I wonder if it's the pecan.
Pointed something.
They're grown in northern Spain.
Yeah, and are they? Would they be spicy? Would anybody know?
You know, we're going to have to rely on our vast radio listening audience out there.
Well, they're usually handpicked and they're roasted over an open kind of fire. And then you peel them by hand and pack them in jars or tins.
Wow, you know, it's probably deals with the
you get a spicy sweet flavor.
It's
there we go.
You know, it's
okay.
The shape of the pepper that's probably contributing to that, because there are some unusual shapes in peppers, and in deference to our to liability issues, I won't go into the shapes that are all available in peppers, but there are some unusual ones.
Yeah. But they're often used. They can be stuffed. You can put them in a tapa.
I don't know. I'm not really familiar with that. Piquillo is. You're right. It's probably.
It's Spanish, northern Spain.
Okay.
Well,
it's
thank
not
you
Latin.
Very much.
Yeah.
It's
thanks
not
a
Latin
lot.
For, something that could be.
Oh no.
I'll try that again. Well, I'm glad I answered the question. Answered the question you didn't ask. Though.
I think that's important.
You don't really. You know.
Yeah. Let's go.
Why bother?
Let's go to Grace in Manitowoc. Grace, hi.
Well, building on this hot subject you just had, I have a sexy question.
Okay.
Ooh. How can one tell the sex of a tree? I have a very nice little, you might say, near adolescent pawpaw. And now I read in the catalog you should have two in order to ensure pollination. Well, it has time to grow, and I've got to buy another tree. If how do I make sure I get the right sex? I had kiwi that I didn't have the male, and therefore no blossoms and fruit till a neighbor came to my rescue. If I can find another pawpaw in the neighborhood, how far does the pollen travel? And
well,
oh,
Grace,
regarding leaves,
you can you'd be you know this is Radio Land, and I don't think you can fully appreciate the sweat beads that are forming on the brows of many of the authorities here at Wisconsin Public Radio at the thought of me answering this question.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, in deference to Irwin, who is my boss, I'm going to have to defer this.
Irwin, what do you think?
Well, let's approach it from the...
Oh, you thought you could do so much better.
did the tree flower this year?
No, it hasn't flowered yet.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to jump the gun and maybe get a partner, but I need to know the sex of or make sure. Will it just any other flowering pawpaw do, or do you have to have sexier trees?
You know, I can find that out.
We're stumped on that
we're stumped
question.
In this one.
We're specialists on the vegetable side, but you know, but clearly, wherever there are dioecious species like this is a dioecious species where there's separate male and female trees, right?
I think the only parallel that I can think of is really a vegetable, right? What, I mean, we do have dioecious vegetables.
We have some dioecious vegetables.
We have spinach.
We have spinach,
right,
that's
for
right.
For example.
That's right.
And we also have some vegetables that cannot be grown as a single plant, such as the tomatillo.
Mm-hmm.
which is not a dioecious plant. It does have a perfect flower. It's a monoecious, but it is self-incompatible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know this from our own experience. One of our neighbors grew one, you know, the tomatillo grows up to be the size of a giant pawpaw. And they only grew one plant, and of course it produced nothing. And that's because it is self-incompatible. So there, you know, these same issues arise in vegetable land.
Yeah.
I would strongly advise, Grace, to not deal, you know, with the anxiety created by this issue, but rather get out the chainsaw and eliminate the problem right at the base, Grace. I think if you remove the pawpaw shade, there's opportunities there for a little leaf mulch and some vegetables to be grown next year.
I'm glad you brought up leaves. For those of us who are on fixed income with the gas prices, if you don't have a mulching mower, chew up the leaves by blocking partly the exit of the lawnmower. Lay the leaves in a windrow, spread a canvas over the lawn chairs so they don't blow all over the place, and chew up the leaves. We did that in Illinois, and we had a fantastic.
You see? Eliminate result. That pawpaw, mulch your leaves, block that exit from your mower, and you'll be able to produce some fine vegetables. Grace, I just have a sense that this pawpaw is causing a lot of distress and anxiety. And I'm not here to give medical advice, but Lord Almighty, I think eliminate the problem, Grace.
And if you don't want to eliminate the problem, what you might do is check with, in Manitowoc area there, you might check with their UW Extension hort agent there.
They won't give any better answer than ours.
Well, they might be able to tell if it's a male or a female. And in that case, if you have a picture or a photo, or if you can even get them to come out and take a look, or one of the tree people, arborists in that area, can take a look at it and tell you if you got a male or a female. And that's probably your best bet, because sometimes it's pretty hard to tell whether you got a male or a female on some plants. So that would be my first advice, is to have one of those horticulturists take a look at it and see what they can come up with. But good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Barb in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Barb.
Hi.
Let's try to avoid any liability issues here, Barb.
Hello?
Yes, Barb.
Oh,
go ahead, Barb.
Yeah, I don't have a garden question, but I do have a haiku, or at least my version of a haiku. And it goes like this. Anticipating, I harvest the garden too soon.
Anticipating, I harvest
the garden too soon.
Too soon.
The garden.
Now, I certainly hope our eggplant lovers are still listening, because I think this haiku is appropriate for them, right?
Well, it's appropriate for me because I know those little red cherry tomatoes look perfectly ripe when I pick them. And as soon as I get in the house and pop one into my mouth, I realize I should have waited.
Yeah. Oh, don't they have high sugars?
They may have high sugars if I leave them on the vine long enough. They look too good.
In other words, you're expressing your need for a little more patience
exactly
in your garden.
Exactly right. Yes. Right. I'm anticipating everything that's going to be in that garden, and I can't stand it one more second.
You're right. Yeah,
I think there are probably many more people like I.
But the cherry tomatoes are coming in pretty early, aren't they?
Yeah, well, ours are. And apparently I'm picking them too early.
Well, don't do that, Barb.
No, I guess I shall not do that anymore. I've realized the error of my ways.
Anticipating, I harvest the garden too soon. Well, now we don't have a traditional haiku here, but it's approaching.
Since Erwin and I make the rules, I think I'm willing to accept this.
The typical haiku is the 5-7-5, right? Yeah. This is more like a 5-7.
5-7. But, you know, we could add another line, which would deal something with chili peppers, right? Anticipating, I harvest the garden too soon, chili peppers are coming. Or patience. Mm-hmm. Patience, Barb. That could end it. It could just be patience. Be patient, Barb.
Patience is a virtue.
Right. Patience is a virtue. That could end it.
That could
patient,
end it.
Let me think. Patience is a virtue.
It's close.
Pretty close, Barb. Yep. I think you made a high cue with that.
Thanks, Barb. Thanks for calling. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Let's turn to Ron in Madison next. Hi, Ron.
Besides garlic, assorted greens, and radishes, what can we still plant in August or later that will produce food, you know, this this fall or even into the winter? Are there some cold weather tolerant greens? A friend told me about some, but I didn't write down the names.
Spinach, I think, would be okay.
Which one? Spinach?
Spinach would be all right.
You can plant spinach in Christmas.
Yeah, you could plant chard.
Chard.
You could plant kale.
Good.
Right.
You could plant beets for greens.
Okay, green beets.
Table beets, red beets, but, use the greens. I think all four of those would work, Jim. The kale would be okay, wouldn't it?
And, I'm transplanting next week, right? I'm putting in my rapini, my broccoli rabe, and I'm also putting in Romanesco. Copious amounts of Romanesco, huh? Do you think I'm going to have a good fall or what?
Huh? Follow-up, please.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, go ahead.
Recent news article talked about golf courses being in trouble. Fewer players, but also higher fuel and fertilizer for nitrogen and phosphorus, potassium, going up to $1,000 a ton, and they were cutting back, less mowing and stuff. One idea came to mind, why not convert some parts of that golf course into community gardens? If the rough, rather than having the rough grow up 2 feet high in grass, why not pick out the best places, the places with silt loam or loam topsoils that are well drained for most vegetables?
What a visionary individual. I hope you're going to run for higher political office because I would absolutely vote
It's a brilliant idea.
This is a brilliant idea.
And a special use for the poorly drained soils. Years ago, Bob Held taught us that field corn gets the best production on somewhat poorly drained soils. So maybe some of the wet areas that aren't right along the fairways could be converted into cornfields, maybe soybeans. Do other edible beans that humans like also grow well in wet soils like soybeans do? That's something I haven't found out yet.
Oh, not snap beans, that's for sure. They'd like drainage.
Beans, okay.
But I'm just fascinated with the idea of converting golf courses into gardens for production.
But not the whole thing. If you got a 100-acre golf course,
rent out five or ten
acres to community gardens, the very best soil that isn't necessary to play golf on, and maybe that will provide enough supplemental income that the people who love to play golf can continue doing that too.
I'd take the whole 100 acres. but if you're going to limit it to 5 or 10, still the opportunity just to have growing anything we could do.
It's a brilliant idea.
A brilliant idea, right? I mean, really.
Your solution would be to go with about 97, 98 acres of vegetables and two of miniature golf.
I'm not a golfer.
Yeah.
I
sit on the University Ridge Oversight Committee.
You're talking to the right guy here.
Ooh, apparently there's some sensitivity issues here. Huh?
I'm on the board of directors. So
he could be the guy to make the decision.
Well, I can bring it up.
I don't know. Golfing is such a painful issue to me because of that it's become – because they're making golf courses in areas of the world that are completely inappropriate. For example, right, the western coast of Central America. I mean, it's basically – they call it the dryland forest. And, the hotels are going up like crazy. And they're building these monstrosities of these golf courses, and there's no water. There's no water. And there's huge political problems occurring because of this, because they're just pumping the aquifers dry to feed these golf courses, which is just an inappropriate use of the land. I'm willing to accept a golf course in Wisconsin, but not in the dryland tropical forest. That I can't accept. So I'm a little sensitive about golf. It's kind of you hit on a touchy issue, okay?
All right. Thanks, Rod. Thanks for calling. Our Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, here on this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller with my guests, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, our Vicars of Vegetables from the UW-Madison Department of Horticulture. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890. And we've got to stay with vegetables today because we're not really into we can't answer tree questions. But we will stay with vegetables. And let's see. Anita in Argyle, I believe, is up next. Hi.
Yes. Hello. We planted some, two pole bean plants, and I think by the middle of June, and, you know, the vines are growing like crazy, but there's no blossoms on them at all.
On your pole bean.
Well, which one? Bush Blue, is it Blue Lake?
I think it's Blue Lake, yeah.
Well, now, what was the haiku that was just read to us by Barb? Anticipation.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I think, Anita, I think we need a little patience out there.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay, that's all we need. I mean, the beans that I work with that we breed are what they call determinate. And they, here, we can, in Wisconsin, we produce, and this is pretty incredible, actually, from the day we plant, and this is in central Wisconsin, right, Hancock, mm-hmm. till harvest is 54 days.
That is amazing.
Isn't it? What a short season crop. But and of course that's for, you know, commercialization. You're dealing with Blue Lake,
and these are indeterminate.
Yeah, these are indeterminate, yeah. And they're the types that were actually domesticated, you know, to crawl up the, you know, in the milpa tradition, right? They were designed to crawl up and twist around the corn plants in the late fall. So it's not a surprise to me that they're a little late. You know what's amazing? Do you really like Blue Lake? Do you like that? Why do you grow the pole bean Blue Lake? Just have extra seed hanging around?
Why do we plant them?
Yeah.
The Blue Lake.
Oh, she likes them. I'm calling for my mother, actually, okay. But she's 94.
Just likes them.
So.
Sure. Well, she like, and you know what? Here's, you know, there are mysteries out there in vegetable land that even Erwin and I don't have answers to.
Uh-huh.
One of them is, this amazes me. The Blue Lake is a classic, it's an heirloom variety, right? It's a classic old pole bean, and it was designed exactly for that. To, you know, it flowers over a very, very long period of time, and it was designed to, it's what they call a type 4. It will climb up anything.
Uh-huh.
It has a unique flavor profile, the Blue Lake.
Uh-huh.
What was observed was a mutation in the Blue Lake,
uh-huh.
which has been observed in lima beans and peas and other beans. And what it did, that mutation made the plant determinate, right? So that it would actually produce, you know, in a very, it would produce
more
a concentrated.
Concentrated, right. Yeah.
I never heard these terms, determinate and indeterminate, applied to vegetables.
So a determinate plant will have its flowers set all at the same time. It'll terminate in a flower cluster that allows those fruits essentially to ripen all together.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas indeterminate, it'll keep going. It'll keep producing new meristems and new flowers.
I see.
And that's why your pole bean is indeterminate, because it'll continue to grow and twist around a corn plant, right, as it continues to grow. Whereas you can have this mutation occur, which will result in a determinate growth habit, in which the inflorescences will terminate in flowers, right, rather mm-hmm. than in vegetative meristems.
Mm-hmm.
And now here's the mystery of science, right? I mean, it's we accept the fact that there are bush beans, right, and
right.
pole beans, right?
Right.
And that's under fairly simple genetic control. What is a mystery of beanland
mm-hmm.
is that when the Blue Lake variety, the pole Blue Lake variety,
mm-hmm.
when the mutation was observed that resulted in the bush Blue Lake, which is another common cultivar now,
mm-hmm.
right, which is this determinate bush Blue Lake, they lost the flavor.
Oh, mm. Uh-huh.
Why did that happen?
Right, right.
Isn't that a... I don't know if this was just a... It's almost as if we were being punished. But, you know, I mean, I can't physiologically think, right? I mean, physiologically or genetically say to myself, wow, if you get a mutation in the gene that causes, you know, indeterminate versus determinate growth habit, mm-hmm. why that should be associated with flavor. Unless you have an answer to that.
No.
Isn't that amazing?
It is an amazing fact.
It's sad in a way, because, you know, you people who like your mother, mm-hmm. who really loves that Blue Lake flavor, but if you grow the bush Blue Lake, it has a different flavor profile.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Isn't that sad?
Yeah.
But for Anita, you think she's going to get her flowers and
oh, yeah,
pods.
She'll get them.
They'll come eventually.
Just take a while, yeah.
I think it was in there. Yeah, I think it was just, she just has to go back and reread Barb's haiku
mm-hmm.
about patience.
Thank you very much, Anita, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Gary in Appleton has a question for you. Gary, hello.
Hi. My question is just about the appropriateness of using grass clippings in the vegetable garden to keep down the weeds and work into the soil.
Yeah, grass clippings should be great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they break down fast.
Kind of smelly, you know.
Yeah.
If that's an issue for you, I don't know.
But a good mulch.
Yeah.
Not at all.
A satisfactory mulch, I think.
Yeah, I do too.
All right, good. Well, you had addressed leaves, and I was just curious as to whether you were
I'm just a leaf guy. You know.
No, the grass blades are leaves too, and I think they sort of fall into that same category, although the broad leaves are better, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And in a way, it's kind of nice to let the grass blades go back on the lawn because mm-hmm. that cuts back on your need to have to fertilize the lawn itself because mm-hmm. that provides a little fertilizer there. Mm-hmm. So, but certainly can work just fine. Thank you for calling, Gary. I had an email from Erin in Green Bay. First, she has a haiku.
Oh, good, good, good.
The farmer's market, good-looking jalapeno. Not enough bite, sad.
Not enough bite. Oh, God.
Seriously, she says, my first trip to a farmer's market was disappointing. I love jalapenos, but I could eat the ones I purchased like a bell pepper. I was expecting much more bite. Is there anything I can do to make sure that the jalapenos are hot if I want to grow them myself?
Oh, well, we discussed this a little bit earlier, and that is that there are jalapeno varieties that have been bred specifically
right.
to have low levels of capsaicin. So what you want to do is go to, you know, a classic, sort of the heirloom type jalapenos, which also are very, very well adapted. I think there's a simple variety. I think it's called early jalapeno. Nothing beyond that. And I've had excellent success. It is early, and I've had excellent success with that. And that does have a reasonably good level of capsaicin. I'm with you, Erin. You got to have some heat in order to make, because heat translates into, it's really another way of saying happiness.
Okay.
Heat and happiness are really, you know, synonymous to me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You got to have it. A bell, you know, if it tastes like, and the bell pepper, there's only two vegetables. Or are there three? The only other vegetable that was voted out in our class was the bell pepper. Because what is it? It's just pretty cardboard, you know, with a little sugar on it. You know, I mean, if you're going to eat a pepper, you should have some capsaicin in there. You got to have some happiness.
Well, let's see what Susan, or Kurtz, I guess, in Kenosha is up next. Kurtz, hello.
Kurtz.
Hi.
What
can you hear me? I'm on a cell phone.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm listening to your program, Wonderful Topics. I'm a seed saver, biodynamic gardener. I have developed a way of growing a garden where I don't grocery shop anymore. And earlier I heard someone calling in and asking what to plant right now.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, I have onions every day of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a variety of onion. It's called the Egyptian walking onion or winter onion.
Yeah, winter onion.
Which is a top-setting onion, and you collect the top-setting seed around this time, and you can replant it right now. It will grow greens that you can start harvesting in November. And if we are lucky to have a little bit of a warm spell, through January and February, you can harvest, collect onions already through the winter. It will survive the winter in Wisconsin.
Thank you.
That's a great suggestion.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant suggestion.
Except for the warm spell during January and February. And Kurtz, I think we've got to, you know, we have to have a reality check here, Kurtz.
Well, sometimes
what are you going to do, shovel the snow out of the way? And
Yeah, you can cover the seedlings because the green actually grow through the snow. If the snow melts in January, you're going to find green onions in the snow. The old-timers, the farmers, would have bales of straw. They would just put the straw around the seedlings and cover them with tarps.
Yeah.
So you remove the tarps and you will find the greens underneath.
Yeah.
I don't do that. I just
Well, honey,
let them grow in the snow and
isn't there a chlorophyll sunlight thing here that I'm... Am I somehow missing that interaction?
No, it's a brilliant idea. And I think what you're talking about here at this plant, it sets a small bulbil, right? It's not a seed, right? But it's a little vegetative. It's almost like a micro bulb, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're using to propagate.
Yes, and yeah. Well, and I got them from my neighbor. She's 96 years old, a lady that was born in Jefferson County, uh-huh. And her great grandma was growing them. So her great grandma's last name was Pfeiffer. So we call them great grandma Pfeiffer's walking onions.
That's
so
cool.
We traced them back to 1850.
And, you know, they're
that's
all
great.
You know, you could probably trace it back all the way because
absolutely.
It's vegetatively, what you're doing is vegetatively propagating.
It's all
vegetative. So it's the same genotype, right, that great-grandma Pfeiffer actually grew. I
wow.
would suggest, though, Kurtz, that you may want to, I don't know if biodynamics allows a little plastic hoop house, but honest to God, I think the best vegetable in the winter is spinach. And you can, and it'll grow,
yeah.
right, in a cold frame. Here in even in Wisconsin, right? So that's my favorite for the winter is a cold frame spinach. Oh, I love it.
And Kurtz, thank you very much for calling. Our guests today, the Vicars of Vegetables, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mealer here with my two guests, Jim Nienhuis and Erwin Goldman, professors of horticulture at UW-Madison and our Vicars of Vegetables. And they're vegetable guys. And when we had a question a while back about pawpaws, we were a bit stumped. And Dr. Laura Jull happened to be listening in.
Fantastic.
And I think she's with us. Laura?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, Laura, thank you so much for helping us on this one.
Oh, no problem.
The pawpaw's not a vegetable, Laura. This is inappropriate.
Yes, but the fruit
Sorry.
Are very tasty.
Oh, they are?
Yes. They
oh,
taste
yeah.
like banana custard.
Mm.
Actually, pawpaw is not dioecious. It doesn't have separate male and female plants.
Is it self incompatible?
It needs cross pollination to mm-hmm. get good fruit mm-hmm. set. And the trees need to be, oh, I don't know, 15 years old or so, or maybe a little bit younger, but they need to be fairly established, good sized plants before they'll start to develop mm-hmm. flowers and fruit.
So, how do you tell?
How do you tell the male from the...
Well, there isn't a male in
no, it's
no,
a
there
perfect
isn't.
Flower.
It's, oh,
a, it's perfect
a perfect
flower.
So, see, I answered this question correctly,
you
Laura.
You did.
When I said the other analogy was self-incompatibility
but will they,
with the tomatillo.
So, but will they set fruit? In other words, are they self-incompatible? Will they set fruit with a single tree?
No.
So they absolutely require it. They must be self-incompatible.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's always exceptions, but they uh-huh. do much better with cross-pollination.
Okay.
Single trees may not fruit at all.
Okay.
So I got
so
it right.
So any
okay.
pawpaw, any other pawpaw tree right next to it
will do
is
it.
Gonna, will do it.
Yeah. And again, they have to be sizable plants, you know,
right.
10, 15, maybe even a little bit older before they'll start to really start producing fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And that plant, I do want people to be aware of, it is a zone 5 plant, so it is very marginally hardy.
Okay.
Here in Madison, we have some nice ones at the UW-Madison Arboretum, and last year there was fruit on it, and I was eyeballing it because I really wanted to try it, and the wild turkeys got it.
Laura, did you feel comfortable with my suggestion that she get out the chainsaw?
No.
Okay. Well,
thanks, Laura.
Okay,
thank you.
Laura, thank you so much.
Thanks very
Excellent.
Much. So, you know, if you're let's say you're 80 years old and you plant your pawpaw and you're hoping for fruit, you're probably,
you better have some good luck.
You better have some good long-lived genes in your background.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Thanks, Laura. Susan in Oregon is up next. Susan, hi.
Hi. I was really surprised that you were discouraging people from growing eggplant. I think it's a really beautiful plant, and you might be able to confirm this for me. I think it's a little bit sexy because I've heard that the eggplants that are shaped more short and round are male, and the ones that are long and slender are female. I don't know if that's true or not.
You know, Susan, we are trained by the university to express no biases. And I can't believe that you interpreted my comments as to dissuade you from growing the pathetic egg, excuse me, the eggplant in any way. Just, it's simply the fact that it, you know, it's a vegetable sponge, Susan. Let's face it.
Well, I used to grow the large eggplant, but I started growing the Ichiban in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Those are the Japanese ones. I really like them because they're fairly prolific. And what I like, and the thing too, is if you leave the eggplant growing too long, the seeds inside get too large, and then
right.
they're not as tasty. But I like to grow those Ichiban eggplants.
Yeah,
and,
yeah. The word tasty
and
eggplant—that's an oxymoron.
I slice them up and saute them with onions and peppers and tomatoes and garlic.
Yeah,
and they're great.
Yeah.
They're really good.
See, so really, she only confirms right, if what Susan is actually saying is that if you can add enough other things to absolutely kill any flavor contributed by the eggplant, and if you can use other sources right to absorb the oil, that it then becomes edible. So has
really
she
good, and I like the texture of the eggplants. That's why I don't peel them. Some people peel them. I like the texture and the flavor, and I think they're real versatile and.
Okay.
And then also,
I can see I've touched a sensitive chord here, Susan. And I, although texture, the word texture and flavor and eggplant strikes me as a complete oxymoron. I'm sorry. I never associate either of those words with eggplant.
There you have it.
But
thanks, Susan.
Susan, going back to your question, though, there's
yeah.
no truth to the idea that there are male and female fruits, if I understood your...
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I hadn't
no.
heard that night.
Yeah, no.
Never heard that
The fruit is basically the swollen ovary tissue from the female. So if anything, it's obviously female tissue, but it's neither female nor male in any kind of regular sense.
All right. Good. Thanks, Susan. Thank you very much for calling. Aviv in Madison is up next. Aviv, hello.
Hello.
And
Aviv, is this you?
Yeah.
This is my daughter calling, Larry.
Oh.
Is she an eggplant lover?
She is not an eggplant lover, as far as I know.
I had a sense that we were touching a sensitive eggplant chord out there.
My wife, though, I will say, who you affectionately refer to as the goddess. Because of her culinary skills.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Can cook with eggplant.
Her beauty... And is complimented only by her culinary skills. Being the goddess. Yes.
Well, Aviv, do you have a haiku for us?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Let's hear it.
First we plant the seed.
First you plant the seed.
First we plant the seeds. Then we water, rake, and care. Then we slice and share.
Slice and share.
That's very sweet, isn't it? Very sweet.
Oh,
that's so nice. I'm so glad you called.
Thank you, Aviv.
Hello from all of us. Hey, Abba.
Hey, guys. It's great that you're listening.
We got the whole
thank
family
you.
Involved.
It's wonderful.
Thanks, kids, for calling. Well, that's nice.
I thought her favorite vegetable was arugula.
She likes arugula.
Okay, great.
She's like Barack.
Oh, just
she's voting for Barack.
Oh, yeah. That's the only way you can do it. I mean, that he won me over. That one comment irritated everyone in Iowa. But I thought. Yes, my kind of guy. He goes for arugula.
He was yeah. he was trying to identify with the Iowan farmers.
Yeah,
by
said, man, you know, I can't tell you the futures market in arugula is like out of this world at this moment. You think you'd have to plant corn, but on the other hand, at least he. Yeah, but at least he knows where the arugula is, Irwin.
Yeah.
I think the opponent may not even know.
Thanks, Aviv, for calling. Thanks, kids. Thank you very much. Oh, man. When is it no longer good to pick asparagus and rhubarb? We're getting a little late into the...
We're talking fibrous now.
Stay away from your... Shift you to your warm season vegetables and leave your asparagus and
rhubarb?
Rhubarb alone.
Rhubarb,
yeah,
too. Yeah,
I think so. Good. Let's go to Sharon in Shattuck. Hi, Sharon.
Well, I just about got my weeding done, and I fed the birds.
Good.
Anyway.
With the weeds?
No, I pulled the weeds and put them on the compost pile,
okay.
But I fed the birds. I still feed birds seeds.
Mm-hmm.
I have a tomato plant. I'm about 5 feet tall. Not
uh-huh.
quite.
Okay.
Taller than I am.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well, it's indeterminate, evidently.
Oh, yeah, it's cool.
So I heard once that you can break the top off at some point in time. When you don't want it to go any higher.
Mm-hmm. That
when
makes
is that
sense.
Time?
But
you've,
okay.
Well, you could do it now, I suppose, but you've sort of passed the time where it's going to help you out much
I've
with the tomatoes.
I've never understood this. I've never understood this phenomenon.
Oh, you're just, against this, aren't you?
I'm not into this at all. Yeah, I know that there
well,
are.
Well, there's about six. There's, 18.
I know, folks. You know, there
it's
are
working
these,
on 24 tomatoes on it.
Yeah, oh. Well, see, like, what's the problem? I know yeah, there are, but there are, colleagues. There are colleagues out there. There are friends out there who insist upon getting out their pruning shears and pruning the tomato, so that in hopes that it will somehow produce more fruit. But my argument has always been. Now, let me think about this. You know, am I just a little bit too logical here? If you're removing the leaves, don't the leaves contribute to the photosynthesis thing?
Well,
that's right.
Yeah, yeah, it would just
so
be the top.
So what's the
but
point
when,
of that?
When I was younger and my now deceased mother, who would have been 95 this year, we didn't stake our tomatoes. They laid on the ground.
Well, I like
were mulched and laid on
sure,
the ground.
Yeah, I'm big on that as well. If you have, you can mulch, you can grow them on the ground. That's not a problem. I mean, the only reason I mulch is you know to eliminate the fruit rot problem.
So
Well,
here's the issue, right? If you remove the upper meristems that yeah. would turn into flowers, presumably, right, you're going to have more energy going into the fruits that you already
that's
have set.
Right.
Since we already very technically defined determinate and indeterminate, mm-hmm. I'll tell you that none of that applies.
What did I say? Indeterminate. Yeah.
None of that actually applies to the tomato.
Yeah.
Okay.
The tomatoes are all indeterminate. There is no such thing as a determinate tomato. The only thing that changes in the tomato is the number of nodes between inflorescences. When we call a tomato like a bush, we call them bush determinate tomatoes. In fact, what they are is that they are setting that they have an inflorescence every second node. Indeterminate, what we call indeterminate tomatoes, the one you're growing, the tall ones, mm-hmm. they tend to have an inflorescence every third or even every fourth node.
And when you say inflorescence, somebody I'm sure is saying what
flower
is
it? Cluster.
Flower cluster, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So presumably if you removed some of the top flower clusters, do you think you could enhance fruit set on the fruits that you already have?
I agree with Irwin that it makes sense. It's just that the thought of bringing pruning shears near my tomatoes. I'm really sensitive about that issue alone.
I got it.
So even though what you're saying is true.
I don't cut Christmas trees either.
And we all agree, even though we all agree that Irwin is right, I still can't accept it because of the pruning shear issue.
Yeah.
That I was going to use my fingernails, but that's okay.
But Jim is also right in the sense of, you know, major pruning, obviously removing foliage is not a good strategy because that's where all the photosynthate is going to be stored.
Right.
Well, this is a pot-grown tomato because I live on, a gravel pit, so they grow in big pots with potting soil.
If you've got 5-foot tall tomatoes in a gravel pit, I say...
Well, she's got them in a pot.
It's not in the soil. Okay. It's a pot.
Okay.
About a 30-gallon pot, and I've done this for years. I've got rose bushes in the same thing, and everything grows just fine.
Thanks, Sharon.
Don't pinch him off, Sharon. I can't take it. It just doesn't seem right.
You're
to me.
Sensitive.
I'm very sensitive
about
this issue.
Sensitive about that.
Very sensitive about this issue.
Marilyn and Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. Well, thank you so much. I want to grow garlic, and I know you start garlic in the fall, correct?
You can, absolutely, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I was at the local feed store, and they had some garlic cloves in a box. You know, that's where I get my potatoes and everything else.
Yeah.
And seeds. And can you give me any help on how to plant them? Do I divide the cloves up into the little parts, or...
Yeah.
Is there anything else that
The bulbs. You divide the bulbs up.
Divide the bulb up into individual cloves, and you can plant those individual cloves in the fall. That's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they don't need any specific extra planting. It would be like planting onion sets?
Right. Right. Okay. Absolutely. And that'll work beautifully here.
It's amazing how winter-hardy that is.
It's a very winter.
Those are the long-neck types, or those hard-neck types.
Hard-neck types.
And they're so... It's amazing how winter-hardy they are.
Yeah. They'll do very, very well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. By the way, we were at State Fair yesterday, was it? Oh, my goodness.
Wednesday.
It was at UW Day at State Fair. And I went through the gardening exhibit because I wanted to see how the vegetables looked. And there were some leeks in that one blue ribbons that were a foot long and as big around as the handle of a baseball bat.
Wow.
They were enormous.
Wow. This is an English tradition. Right?
This idea of growing large vegetables.
Yeah. Remember that book by Bernie? What was his name? Bernie?
Yeah.
Bernie Lavery was like into really, really big vegetables. Now the leek, I'll have to say though, boy, if there's a vegetable that's well adapted to Wisconsin.
Leeks,
I mean, are just exquisite. Not only that, you know what I love about the leek? I mean, I start my seed in February, right? I mean, it's blustery cold out there, and, you know, I mean, it's just miserable. Go down to the basement, go to the greenhouse, plant my leeks, and then I transplant them in late March or April, and then I have beautiful. The secret to beautiful leeks is organic matter, right? I mean, you just put them into. That leaf mulch, it's another reason to have leaf mulch out there.
Yeah, to be
organic matter all about, and covering up the stems.
There's nothing quite as exquisite as a caramelized leek.
Oh,
they're very
wow. Isn't that a fabulous?
Or my personal favorite is to have that salmon, if I could, I can't afford it anymore, but salmon and potato leek soup in the fall is just, I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leek is underappreciated vegetable.
Well, these were big leeks. Mm-hmm, yeah. I mean, the ones that I always grew were like the size of my little finger.
Mm-hmm. No. I mean, they can be large. I mean, you can.
Well, you transplant, right? So Jim, you're starting your seeds in February.
Yep.
And then taking them out to the field. Yeah. So by this time, I guess they are quite.
No, my leeks are pretty good. But if you want to grow giant leeks, but you know, but there's something odd about the fact that we have a culture that loves, you know, that loves the giant vegetable, which, except for the giant pumpkin.
I was just going to say. You
know, okay, yeah. I mean, I'm certainly into the giant pumpkin, but I'm not into, size for the, you know, sake of size alone.
Like the 20-pound cabbage.
This is inappropriate. Yeah. Yeah, this is inappropriate. Because, you know, for the most part, you may gain a ribbon at the fair, but they don't have the same flavor. That leek, on the other hand, it will be fine. Right? I mean, they do have, but I mean, to have just big peppers or to have big tomatoes just for the sake of having them big is not going to contribute to the culinary excellence of that vegetable, in my opinion.
I would agree with that.
And I think it's unfortunate that we imported this tradition from the English.
Well, it's a feat of engineering. I mean, in that book, he describes growing a giant carrot in a drain pipe. I mean, you grow it actually in a gutter. You buy, you know, a 20-foot piece of gutter, and then you fill it with soil and tilt it and grow a giant carrot. Now, it's kind of an engineering marvel.
It is. But, you know, but again, they're doing it in a climate, right, where you, I mean, that's. You know, it's a lot milder.
It's a milder climate.
Much milder climate, and they can do that. Now, on the other hand, what I do think is spectacular is, of course, the giant pumpkin.
That is only, a thing of beauty.
But only when we're allowed to sail them on Lake Mendota.
Yeah.
When is your regatta, by the way?
That's a great idea. You know, of course, we are growing the giant pumpkins. We've got them out at the West Madison Ag Research Station. Did I get that right this
perfect,
time?
Perfect.
So I won't get a phone call from them.
Not an angry phone call.
No angry phone calls. Yeah. I've got them out there. I do have two little problems, and that is just the two problems are vine borer and water.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, things are doing great. But I think we're going to have, we will have our giant pumpkins this year. And
that's in October, isn't it?
And I think, when did we do it?
October.
Is it October? It's like the first
week of October.
Probably the first Saturday of October. Mm-hmm. Unless it's a home football game. Then we generally go the week before.
Or we could challenge the opposing team.
Yeah.
When they come to town.
Fun thing to do. Yeah.
Well, that's a possibility. Are you going to come to our giant pumpkin regatta? Anyone coming to that? One of our listeners? It's a fun event.
It's a fun event.
And you can print out the waiver on our website
join
us.
Yeah. There's no liability.
And you need a waiver, too.
There are no liability issues at all associated with this event that I'm aware of.
I remember the first year when the pier collapsed.
Oh, and Irwin's and the goddess remembers that Well, has she ever forgiven me?
We're hoping that she's going to start talking to us again after that. It's been a long four years.
It's been a long 4 years, yeah. But she's moving towards forgiveness. I'm so pleased to hear that.
I have a question, an email, excuse me, from Barb in Green Bay, who's been growing butternut squash in the same spot as last year, but this year she has lots of small, wrinkly, tough, leathery leaves and lots of squash bugs.
Yeah.
Am I dealing with one problem or two, and is a squash a crop that needs to be rotated?
You know, that's a really good question. You know, when I have issues, because I'm a squash lover as well, when I have issues with squash vine borer and I can't rotate, ironically, the one crop that I do grow is butternut because butternut is a different species. It is Cucurbita machata. It is not a pepo or a maxima. Most of the squashes that we grow are actually Cucurbita pepo. Machata, it must be the orientation of the vascular tissues. It tends to be more resistant to squash vine borer. So I tend to grow butternut. So I'm very sad to hear that even her butternut are going down to squash vine borer, and I'm especially sympathetic because I specifically chose to grow my giant squash over at the West Madison Station because it was it had been a cornfield for 150 years, and I kept telling everyone, I thought, I won't have to worry about vine borer over there. There hasn't been a vine borer in that area for the last 100 years. But they got me.
They
found me somehow. So I would guess that you're probably, maybe they're, Phil Pelletieri might know better, but there must have been a heck of a flight of vine borer this year because I see a lot of damage.
There's not much you can do to keep them off the squash.
No, there isn't. I mean, it's one of those things where you just have to take, that's the joy, the karma, the metaphor of gardening, right? I mean, it is, you have to sort of take your losses. I mean, it may be a bad year for the squash with butternut, but on the other hand, it's a wonderful year for onions. It's a wonderful year for tomatoes, and it looks like it's going to be a spectacular year for peppers. So there's always this compensation out there in garden land.
You have
a
wonderful philosophical approach.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
There's no way to cover. You could cover them with a row cover or anything like that.
I think even I've tried cursing and
how about the bug vacuum?
That's one of my favorite. You ever see? You know what they use in California on the lettuce? They don't use any. I don't know if it's organic, but they have this machine called they have this giant vacuum cleaner that goes through the lettuce plants, and it just sucks up everything into this giant 40-ton container. I can't, and of course, that's the good news. The bad news is we're dealing with the California sun, and when you leave that 40-ton container out there, the smell is so permeating. Mm-hmm. But that's how they produce lettuce. They vacuum up the bug. No, I just think you have to be philosophical about these things and accept our losses and glory in those things that are doing well.
And that's a perfect way to end, I think. Thank you both very much for being with us. You'll be back in a month or so. We'll do this
again.
We'll do it again. Jim Nienhuis, UW-Madison Professor of Horticulture, and Erwin Goldman, Professor of Horticulture, Associate Dean in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And they are our Vicars of Vegetables. Always fun to have them along, and they'll be back, and we will do this again with them. Just a look ahead, on Monday, we'll be talking physical therapy issues with Bill Boisenault, Associate Professor in the University of Wisconsin Medical School, and also Lori Tyne Brody, Bill's sidekick from the University of Wisconsin Sports Medicine Center, and they always have a lot of fun. And if you've got an ache, a pain, a sprain, or a strain, they're the people to call. Give them a call. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.